Next up on This Week in Law, we're going to talk about books, Scanned, Banned, and No Man's Land. We're going to give you actually two undecillion reasons to listen all the way through the show, because there's a great discussion, too, about machine intelligence and the law. We're going to try and unravel for you next on This Week in Law with Christian Turner, Joe Miller, Evan Brown, and me.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 263, recorded June 13, 2014. More bodies on Blackacre. Hey, folks, it's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Welcome. We're so glad you're here this week, because we have an incredible panel joining us to talk about some really fascinating issues, great stories, and a great way to close out the school year. We have two professors joining us today, both from the University of Georgia School of Law, both from their own wonderful show, which I think is only 5 or 6 episodes old at this point, called Oral Argument. Highly recommend it. These guys are hysterical and funny and erudite, and you're going to love them. Here they are. We've got Christian Turner joining us. Hello, Christian.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Oh my gosh, it's so fun to have you. I discovered your show a few episodes ago when we had one of your colleagues on our show, and she had just been on with you, Christina. And yeah. So now we're thrilled to have you both on, including Joe Miller. Hello, Joe.
Hello.
Great to have you. Tell us, each of you, starting with Joe, what you teach at University of Georgia.
I teach patent law, antitrust law, an IP survey class, and, you know, things in that wheelhouse.
And Christian?
Oh, man. I teach property. I teach land use. I do a course in regulation of information, one in modern legal theory. You know, kind of a grab bag.
Yeah. So all over the board, lots of stuff right in our wheelhouse on TWiL. Also joining us, of course, my co-host, Evan Brown from the InfoLaw Group. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. How are you today? I'm really looking forward to this conversation as usual. We do have some fun topics on the list to get to, so it'll be a good one.
We do. Joe and Christian, are you guys schools out for the summer yet, or are you still winding things up?
No, school's out. Grading is done. And now it's writing, researching, podcasting, taking care of kids, taking care of dogs. It's a different kind of busy.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's been a busy week for things to do with books. We have lots of stories on things to do with books. Some of them are in the copyright arena, so let's start there.
I thought we were supposed to provide the audio there.
I know, I was waiting for you to chime in with the baseline, Evan.
We usually do anyway, so I guess that was kind of a joke on me.
Right. Let's talk about the latest decision in lawsuits related to Google Book Search, the HathiTrust case. The Second Circuit has held to the way it has found in the other offshoots of this case, and in favor of fair use and the libraries. So the Authors Guild, although it's probably frustrated that it keeps losing these cases, it's really, you know, not such a bad thing. One of the things that came out in this particular decision is that you're able to search the whole entire HathiTrust database for topics, not necessarily to see the full text of what an author has written, but just to see whether they've written on this topic, and that's in the HathiTrust database. So that's a good thing for authors, even though the Authors Guild would have rather seen this case come out the other way. Pamela Samuelson from Berkeley has a good article on why authors win, even if the Authors Guild lost, is her title. So throwing it out there to our esteemed panel, I guess there are no surprises here, but all good news. What do you think, Joe?
Well, maybe not a surprise, but, you know, the Ninth Circuit, a different court, has done a lot more with the fair use and search engines, things like image-based search, using thumbnails of photographs for image-based search. So I don't think the Second Circuit had done anything as clear as they've just done in this HathiTrust case. And it's interesting because it's not really the main event with respect to Google and these book scanning projects. So, you know, Google with book search shows you some snippets from the book. It doesn't just give you a data sheet that describes your query. I looked for this word in this book. That word appears on these pages. Google actually shows you snippets. And so that's most like the photograph thumbnail in the Ninth Circuit cases. So now the Second Circuit is agreeing with the Ninth Circuit. Hey, this, you know, search engine technology is highly transformative. And that's really the buzzword in fair use analysis. Is the thing the accused infringer is doing transformative? Does it take the copyrighted work and make use of it in a new and interesting way that adds value so that we should, yes, the search engine does add a lot of value? I think that's the right, I think it's the right answer. And it's great to see.
Christian, your take on this?
I agree with Joe. It's not, I'm not the IP expert that he is, but, my students would probably be surprised to hear it, but it seems to me like an easy case. I don't really see how it could come out the other way. I normally say anytime people are fighting about something, it's usually because, you know, they have different interests and it reveals there's something kind of difficult to decide. In this case, I don't really see it. I would rely on Joe to help me figure out, like, you know, why I should think it should have come out any other way.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a little while about big data and machine analysis and the law. And it seems to me that before we can even get to a point where the law is truly transformed by what technology can do for it, we need to have some fundamental getting copyright law out of the way to allow copies to be made and searching to be done effectively. Evan,
it's funny.
Any thoughts? Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that it's funny, isn't it? The fair use test, which is statutory now, relies on this idea of, you know, the use being transformative among other factors. And that's really not, that's the wedge into which this issue was kind of pushed. But that's really not the thing, right? That's not what makes it seem totally reasonable to have this capacity, despite the ownership of the copyrights by the authors. It's that it's so useful, right? It's useful and it doesn't hurt too much the authors. And in fact, as you say, there's evidence saying that it's helpful to the authors. But it's insanely useful. And that's the, to rule another way would expose one of the huge costs of copyright. Because we have the technology to make all of these books, you know, say to the students sometimes, everything ever recorded, everything ever written, we have the technology to make this available to all of us instantly whenever we want it. And if we're not going to do that, because law says we're not going to do that, there has to be some really good reason, right, to deny people what we can easily do. And in this case, it doesn't seem like there is anything close to that kind of reason.
Yeah, I agree. And it seems to me, aside from the mere utility for people doing research, to get back to Professor Samuelson's point, that search is integral to keeping an author's book alive over time. That you can write, you know, a wonderful piece of work on a topic that just gets lost in the ether for decades unless you're able to search it and find it down the road, at which point, you know, once again, it not only is beneficial to the author, but to everyone with whom the author shared that creativity or knowledge. Evan, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, well, just to pick up on one point right there, doesn't even get lost in the ether. It gets lost in the moldy stacks until somebody happens to be literally walking through there. So just a couple of points also to pick up on what Christian said. Yeah, at this point, almost a decade later, it does seem like an easy case because we've had so many times to rehearse it and think of the fair use factors in our mind as we're thinking about it. And it's also helpful when we have language from the Second Circuit in this opinion saying that the making of the digital copy for the purposes of search is a quintessential, I think that was the term they use, a quintessentially transformative use. So that makes it easy for us to sort of go along with. If we take a longer view of history, though, I guess what we really need to do is go back to recalling the first time we heard about what Google was doing sometime in 2004, 2005, whenever we, you know, would have first gotten the news. You know, try to rekindle that sense of awe and amazement. It was like, my gosh, this is an enormously ambitious project, and this is really going to change things. And with that mindset, I think it's more difficult to see it as an easy case. I realize that was a strange thing to say, more difficult to see it as easy. But you can recognize that, you know, it's become an easier analysis for us to make because we've had the time period to sort of allow those neural pathways in our brain to become well-trodden, to see this as a fair use. But, you know, it's such an ambitious project. Wow, certainly it is going to present some copyright issues, and no wonder it has taken a long time to start actually seeing some real resolution now. So it really is watershed, no doubt about it. Certainly one of the big milestones in the history of copyright law, which, you know, with the way that the technology has occasioned such an innovative use to be so disruptive to the traditional notions of what we think about in copyright.
Yeah, just this morning on Google Book Search, I found this quote that hopefully Joe and Christian will appreciate from Erica Jong's 1973 book, Fear of Flying, which is the funniest book. I kind of missed the window for reading that book because I was 8 at the time. But someone in our book club that I attend from time to time lost it in the ring, and I'm listening to it on audio now. And it is hysterical. It's like as though a Woody Allen story were told from the Diane Keaton character's standpoint. Anyway, her quote was, "It occurred to me that graduate school was seriously interfering with my education." And, you know, I mean, she's just full of little witticisms like that. And the only way, you know, for people to surface them these days, so many decades down the road, is either to have someone say, you know, hey, this book from 30 years ago, 40 years ago is worth bringing back. It is 40 years, huh? Oh, that's just frightening. or, you know, if you're searching for things related to wasting your time in graduate school, you might just stumble on this in Google Book Search.
And waste even more time.
Right, exactly.
Cory Doctorow, an author who I think we might talk about for another story.
Yes.
You know, he says, look, an author's problem for the most part isn't piracy, it's obscurity. So the power of these search tools that resurface things, as you just say, you know, it's so vital. And I agree with Evan that when the Google Book Search project first got announced.
Oh, that's too bad because he was agreeing with me.
You dropped out, Joe.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
The best part, by the way, because you were agreeing with me.
Yes.
Is he there now?
Nothing better than being in violent agreement with the hosts.
Well, I was going to say while we wait for him to come back that, you know, someone who's been through, you know, grad school and law school and now teaches and a little bit of work too. That quote kind of resonates because I think it shows us that it's not enough to go through the motions of kind of hitting the marks in school. If that's what you're doing, you know, it's about learning. And unless you learn new things and uncover new ideas, it's really wasted. And so, you know, school is not necessarily just about learning a syllabus. It's about, you know, uncovering new ideas together, you know, with the class, with the professor, learning things that no one thought you were going to learn in the beginning. And And this whole process of learning what we want to do as a society with copyright is kind of like that. You know, reminded, we were talking about this just the other day, kind of Larry Lessig's mea culpa after the Eldred decision, that, mm-hmm. you know, he felt like he lost that case. This is the Copyright Term Extension Act case, because he couldn't get the justices to feel it, to feel what the harm was with these very long copyright periods. They just didn't have experience with, you know, what would be wrong with it. And I feel like we've been through at least a couple of decades now, maybe three, where more and more people are interacting and hitting up against copyright directly and gaining experience with, you know, how that law works. Whereas, you know, maybe back in the day when people, the audience for most people was their immediate neighborhood and family, you know, you could pass things around and copy things, make mixtapes, and you just never ran up against kind of the sharp edge of the law. And so there's a lot of learning as a society that we've been through, I think, to get to this point, to make it, you know, as Evan chimed in as well, to make it seem like an easy case, but it was hard work to get there.
Right. Well, the more we learn, the more... Oh, good, Joe, you're back.
Yeah, if I could just jump in. Just as a practical matter, one thing that made the case take a lot longer than it might otherwise have taken, and I think it's turned out for the good for Google, is that... you know, they were working on a settlement agreement for a long, long time. And then that settlement agreement got reviewed by the court and they couldn't ever make it stick. And so there was a lot of time that was spent not actively working through in court what the issues were and who should prevail. So that what turned out to be that hiatus to try to settle the case is, again, I think all kinds of other cases with fair use got decided, and now when Google finally presses its advantage in the Second Circuit, you know, it's scoring what now look like easier victories.
Right. The more we learn about copyright and how it should work and how people need to be able to access copyrighted works, the more we seem to still find things to stumble over. And I forget if it was you, Christian, or you, Joe, who tweeted about this. I think we may have even talked about it on the show last month when it was in the headlines. But it was an academic publisher called Aspen who was attempting to sort of follow the Amazon Kindle or iTunes model for their hard copy textbooks, where what the student would get when they bought, I think these were legal casebooks, they would get the physical book to use during the school term, and they would get unlimited access to the online resources that went along with the property casebook. But at the end of the term, they would have to turn their book back in because that really all they were buying was a license to use the book temporarily. And this raised a lot of eyebrows. And I guess they wound up updating their policy after the brouhaha took place. And what they told kids was they could buy the physical book to keep or buy a digital version and a print version and return the latter. So it's a weird kind of business model they're trying to pursue here, and seems to be of concern because they may not be alone, as you know, the publishers try and respond to things like, say, losing the Google Books and antitrust cases. You know, as they back and fill and attempt to do everything they can to protect copyrights, maybe this is the kind of model that they would think would be a good idea. What do you think of this, Joe?
Well, a lot, actually. One thing I need to say, just in the interest of full disclosure, is that I'm actually the co-founder and co-owner of a law casebook publishing company. So mm-hmm. I'm a competitor of Aspen's after a fashion, and so people should know that and take what I say with a grain of salt or a pound of it accordingly. But because you could say I have an axe to grind, but now I'll proceed to grind it. you know, I think this. So yes, they changed what they were doing as it was unfolding. So at a bare minimum, they sort of had a rolling disclosure that was pretty awkward and pretty fumbled. How things have turned out recently, and you know, the law prof listservs in IP at least continue to churn through this issue. So this is an issue that for the professors hasn't gone away. And what it looks like now is that the price of the paper book plus web resource, where you have to return the paper book at the end of the semester, it looks like that's priced at about $185, and the book alone with no electronic resource that you can keep forever if you want is about $225. So it's about a $40
difference. US dollars, $225.
Correct, for this Duvenir and Career property book by Aspen, probably the leading property law, traditional property law casebook that's out there. And so they are making both available. You have a choice as a student consumer when your professor picks this title for you to use, and that won't be your choice as a student, but you'll be able to buy one of these two versions, and it'll be up to you. Which you want to do. Now, I do think it's fairly clear that what a lot of publishers want to do is to draw in the college or professional school textbook market is dry up the supply of used copies, and that this strategy may help them do that over a course of years when they roll it out to all their titles. Right now, it's a very small number of titles that they're trying this with. Okay. And I just think all of this and a lot of other things about it, too, are a sign that the casebook publishing market for law schools anyway just isn't particularly competitive right now. It's got a small number of large players. They're kind of sclerotic. They do weird things that are sort of hostile towards students. And the sort of thing you wouldn't expect people to do in a thriving competitive market with lots and lots of suppliers. And again, I say this as someone who is now one of those suppliers since 2008, with a very different approach, which we don't need to talk about. It'd be take too long here, but I think it's a weird strategy. But until you remember, well, there's this thing called first sale, and when you buy a book, you get to resell it. It's why we have libraries, used bookstores, yard sales, and all sorts of other things that culturally we're very accustomed to.
Right.
Yeah.
And it strikes me as weird to even be talking about physical casebooks in this day and age. They weigh 30 pounds, maybe. I mean, they're just these enormous things. They're impossible to move around with you as you try and find a good place to study. So it seems to me that digital resources have got to be part and parcel of how people learn in the future, especially in law school, just because the amount of material you're expected to review for a course is so vast.
Can I put in a plug for something here?
Please.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, Joe and I talked about this on episode 20 of our show, actually. We spent most of the show on textbooks because they're terrible. And In my estimation, no student should have to pay for a textbook. In fact, I haven't assigned a commercial textbook that students have had to buy since 2007, I think. Joe's model, you know, he says he's a publisher as if he's, a fat cat publisher or something like that. But in fact, he's got, his publishing company works kind of on the Radiohead and Rainbows model where the students can pay what they want for the text. And I think they suggest $30, right, Joe?
Yeah, we suggest $30, but that's just a suggestion. Most people pay it, but we think the most important thing for a student to do is to have the educational materials that have been assigned to them. So if they decide to pay zero, just download the PDF, they're welcome to do that.
Yeah, and I, for my part, I built in around 2007, I built a Rails app that allows professors to make a casebook, kind of like you make a playlist in iTunes or Spotify or whatever. People can upload snippets of content, whether they're cases or short descriptions. But the bits of content then are ordered like a playlist, and it outputs using LaTeX and other things. It outputs a PDF copy, a web copy, and an ebook copy of the resulting book. And professors could share these. You can copy chapters, individual units. So it works, I think it works very, very well. But getting adoption of something like that, you know, you obviously need a network effect to drive it. But I've been using it to make all my own textbooks now for about 6-7 years. And, you know, saving a lot of money for the students in the process. And I think if everyone adopted a system like that, and I think Harvard has, at the Berkman Center, they have this H2O project, which is trying to do some of the same stuff. You'd get better books, not just cheaper books, but better books. So that's what, you know, I hope we all move in that direction.
Along these lines, let me ask our two professors something about, I guess, specific to the world of law school casebooks. That's interesting to me because published legal opinions are, well, I mean, we could go back and forth on the extent to which they're copyrightable, but if you are simply accessing the published opinion of a court through the court's own or the state's own or the federal government's own resources, generally there's no copyright involved. You're able to, you know, it's part and parcel of how we make law in the country, and you're able to access that. And we've decided it's a good thing for everyone to be able to access that freely. So I'm wondering if you have seen professors, or if either of you have ever thought about, you know, we don't need a casebook. All the law is out there. We'll just tell you what cases to go read.
Well, I do some of that with my classes, with, you know, my project, which is also called Hydrotext. That's where the name Hydrotext got started, because that's, you know, how these things are made. They're bits of content stitched together. And a lot of that content in law school is cases. Not entirely. I mean, there's narrative, bits of statutes, small snippets of articles. So it's not all cases. One of the I think the hardest parts about making a traditional law school casebook is well, there's one, there's picking out the right cases which best exemplify the principles that you're trying to teach. But also exerting those cases, because the cases can be quite long. You know, 80-page Supreme Court opinions are not all that unusual these days, and you just can't ask students to read 2 80-page opinions for a 1-hour class typically. So, and that takes a lot of time. You know, I do a lot of, you know, it's taken a lot of my time as I prepare materials for students to do that excerpting. And, you know, the copyrightability question is interesting, because I think excerpting cases may just be creative enough to say that an excerpted case is copyrightable. You know, my view is, you know, shoving all that to one side, I think that if it isn't a correct statement of current law, it ought to be through statute or otherwise, but I think is arguably true nonetheless. When you use a piece of information or a written work that was not intended for education itself, I think that should be considered a fair use. And I think our whole country is shooting itself in the foot when teachers have to use less good substitutes because they don't want to go through the rigmarole of clearing copyrights, which would probably be cleared anyway. So there's an easy kind of statutory fix for that for most materials. But yeah, cases are the big one, and cases generally aren't copyrighted, but excerpts of them and the arrangements are copyrightable like other kinds of compilations.
And my favorite bit of reading on this topic was from Professor Grimmelman, who of course is also the go-to expert on all the Google Books and HathiTrust stuff, in writing about, if you want to call this DRM for physical books, big beef was, it's all well and good if you're giving someone unlimited and lifetime electronic access to whatever your platform is. But then he says, we know from sad experience that gerbils have better life expectancy than DRM platforms. So he's not putting a lot of faith in what kind of access you're purchasing.
Yeah, nor should he. And it is disturbing that, you know, when you think about, I know that some law professors inquired of Aspen, you know, what are you going to do with these books that get returned, right? I mean, what are you going to do with them physically? Mm-hmm. And the answer was, in not so many words, we're going to destroy them, right? We're going to pulp them. So all the notes that students have written in the margins, all the highlighting they've done to try to remind themselves of something, all the ways that a student makes a book his or her own, to make it usable to them. That will all get eliminated, trashed, literally put in the trash. And so it's just bizarre. You're in this situation where you've got the company that's all about providing educational materials saying, we take the actual concrete embodiment of your learning and we pulp it. That's just weird.
What an environmental outrage, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Going into this.
Feeling for the poor students. My favorite thing when I was a student was to buy the used textbooks because you sort of a la Harry Potter in his potions class, you were getting some helpful notes from those who came before you.
Misleading notes. Yeah, you don't know what you're going to get, right? Until you get halfway into the class.
I always notice there are usually a lot of, highlighting and margin notes and underlines in the first five pages. And then after that, you can tell the student lost enthusiasm for that semester. It's like, oh, man, I'm going to get all A's this semester. Oh, yeah. Get
And Denise, I'll blame you for bringing up James, but let me put a plug in for him. James Grimmelman is one of the people who publishes his casebook through my publishing company, his Internet Law Casebook. So he really is he's terrific, great author. His Internet Law Casebook is great, very popular. So James just doesn't just talk the talk, he walks the walk. So I think that's great.
Joe, what is the name of your publishing company? You might as well go ahead and plug it.
Sure, Semaphore Press. So Semaphore, like the signal flags, Semaphore Press.
Very cool.
Because all the books are printed on flags, I think. That's the other
recycled.
That's the
flag.
Other gimmick. That's the other gimmick. Yeah.
Yes. Sure.
It's a cloth.
From time to time during the show, we put some phrases in for people who are listening for MCLE credit in their jurisdiction. If you need information on doing that, head over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Go to the This Week in Law page there, and we've got some information for you. We put these phrases in case your oversight body needs to see that you actually watched or listened. We can verify that if you know these phrases. And the first one for this show is going to be ancient gerbils. So write that down if you are listening for legal or professional education credit. Let's do one final copyright story before we move on to more things about books and other things. And this is a follow-up to our last week's discussion of the AMC series Halt and Catch Fire, which now having seen the second episode, I can happily say that they've done a little bit more explanation of the whole process of reverse engineering and the legalities of what's going on in the show. Still not a whole lot, but at least you can follow along and know what's going on there. So we got an email from listener Greg, who had just finished watching both the Halt and Catch Fire show and our analysis last week and was very curious why Phoenix, which was the company that we mentioned as someone who famously reverse engineered an IBM PC and did it in a legal way, why Phoenix writing a new BIOS based on a functional spec is legal, yet Google writing a new Java library based on a published spec is not. And we're talking about the lengthy litigation between Oracle and Google concerning Java here. They both seem to me, I'm a programmer by profession, writes Greg, to be the same thing. So what's the legal difference? And Joe promised us he'd take a crack at that.
Yeah, well, I think one important thing to do for Greg is we have to put patent law entirely to the side, right? So because patent law complicates this a lot. But
I'm all for that.
if you just focus on copyright law, I actually think if it were true that the only thing Google did was write a brand new Java library of its own based on a published specification, I think Greg is right. There wouldn't be any difference. The clean room procedure, the multi-step clean room procedure that you all described last week in your episode, which I watched, that sounds like what all you're doing is you're getting an understanding of functionality, and then you're writing your own code. So you're writing your own copyright protectable work, which is the expression of the code in the particular programming language that you decide to write. And all you're doing is making sure you catch the right functionalities. That would be the same thing Google does in Greg's question, writing their own brand new Java library based on a published spec. But my understanding of the Google v. Oracle case is that's not the only thing Google did. So some of the allegations relate to actually copying verbatim the software code itself for some of the Java-related items that Google wanted to use. Now, there are additional arguments about why that, even if you copy verbatim, that isn't copyright infringement. It's a fair use argument, or an argument about the fact that the Java code is not copyrightable because it is a function, a piece of functional equipment, in essence, and therefore simply falls outside the scope of copyright. Now, so far, Google has not been winning on those arguments, at least not at the Court of Appeals. So I think it's back to trial court with that stuff. How's that? How'd I do?
Good. Far better than I could have done with that.
Yeah,
really,
it's quite a relief. Part of the biggest difficulty I have as a speaker of English is when I wander off into talking about the idea expression dichotomy. So it was a relief to hear you talk about something that gets to that issue, have somebody else doing the talking and doing it so well. So,
thank you.
All right, let's stay with our book theme. You mentioned Cory Doctorow's book. We're getting a little far afield from technology law in talking about this, but we've had Cory on the show. People who listen to the show are no doubt familiar with Cory and have probably read a lot of his books, including Little Brother, which has the distinction now of being Cory's first book to have been banned by educators at any institution, in this case, a high school in Florida. And I'm not, terribly clear on why this happened or what happened, but initially the book had been assigned as summer reading, and then the administration apparently took a look at the book and decided, no, we're not actually going to scrap the whole program that involved having children read this over the summer and then talk about it at the end of the year, which is sad and unfortunate, although I think Cory no doubt will wear it as a badge of honor, and I'm hoping that he'll even take the ban of his book and shrink it down to wallet size and carry it around with him along with his tiny version of the Bill of Rights. Deserves that kind of treatment, I think. And he did take the great step, too, of donating 200 copies of the book that had been banned to the school for its library. So he and his publisher did that. That was awesome. I guess we could talk about the legalities of banning books, what sort of latitude schools have to do this, if there are First Amendment considerations that come into play, or we could talk about anything you'd like relating to Cory and his book. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I'm going to let Christian take a crack at a First Amendment issue, but I just want to say, and I'm going to give him a little time to think about it, because I want to say that I've read Little Brother. I read it when it first came out. I love Cory's work. I read most of what he writes. And I think he's such a powerful and interesting thinker about copyright, about IP policy. For someone who's not a sort of IP lawyer or law professor, I think he leaves so many IP folk in the dust with his creativity and his energy. So I think it's great. And I love that he donated the 200 books. I think that's exactly the right answer. Just say, okay, you don't want kids to read it. I'm just going to make sure they have as many copies as available to them. As they want,
right.
Sorry,
I was just going to say, here's our tech law tie-in. The subject of Little Brother is very foreshadowing NSA surveillance and everything that has come to light about that. Even though the book was written in 08, so there's definitely national security and privacy issues that the students would have been thinking about and analyzing and discussing had they been able to do so in their academic context. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I think you're right in terms of you set the clock back 6 years, and it's amazing how many things he sort of foresees that we're currently grappling with. It looks, if you pick up the book today, you read it and you think, oh, yeah, this is taken right out of the Snowden stuff and all these other things. And it's like, yeah, but Cory wrote it 6 years ago. So right. none of that had happened yet that we knew about. I mean, it was all happening, of course, but we didn't know. But now I'm just so eager to hear Christian's First Amendment take on schools managing what students read in their libraries.
Yes.
Well, I am not a First Amendment expert, but it's hard for me to say that there's a strong First Amendment right of a student to have educators not make content decisions about books. It sounds like, and I have not read the book, but it sounds like a dumb decision. It sounds like the kind of thing that communities ought to discuss. One could easily imagine a book that we would all agree is not appropriate for assigning a summer reading to a whole school district. It's certainly possible to think of such a book. It just sounds like it was dumb to think this was one of those kinds of books.
Right. Fear of Flying, maybe? I could see that not being such a great idea.
I was just thinking that.
Or
there is a little bit of sort of teenage romantic life going on in this book, but that is not what I think drew down the objections of the administration.
Yeah, and I've blogged before about what I think are some of the excesses of kind of First Amendment triumphalism. You know, turning everything into a First Amendment case, and Joe and I have talked about it on the show before too. That said, you know, I've like the Bong Hits for Jesus case and other student speech cases, which I don't have at my fingertips. I remember them a little bit. I've discussed them with my student Supreme Court groups here at the house, actually. And I would like to see stronger protections for student speech, but this is something else. This is about educators selecting materials to assign as summer reading, as I understand, not just to appear in the library, which might be a somewhat tougher issue.
Right.
And as to that, I think, you know, educators are invariably going to have to make decisions about content. And so it's hard for me to get exercised about this as a First Amendment issue. Mm-hmm. But it's very easy for me to say this is probably a really dumb decision that people should, you know, if, you know, again, not having read the book, but for those who have and think it was a really stupid decision, protesting this decision is absolutely warranted if that's the case. But that's what our society is about. It's about people kind of arguing about, you know, how we're going to teach our kids, what kind of community we're going to have. So I think maybe the First Amendment angle may obscure more than it helps to illuminate what's really difficult about this.
Well, this is the first time I've really thought about this story side by side with the one it's side by side with in our rundown today, which is the topic of trigger warnings. And this is the first time I've ever really thought, well, okay, so maybe there's better to have, even though I'm not in favor of trigger warnings in general, it sort of just smacks me as something that we don't need to put on educators to have to decide when one is appropriate and when one is not. But better to have something like that in this kind of instance than to just ban the book outright. If you have concerns about the book having themes of questioning authority, or if you have concerns about the romantic content of the book or whatever else, you know, maybe let parents know that, let students know that, and still assign the book. So let's talk about trigger warnings since I've gone ahead and brought it up. And my theory on the topic after having watched all the debate rage over the last few weeks is that the whole thing was manufactured by the writing staff at Portlandia so that they could have show fodder for next season. But assuming that I'm wrong about that, a lot of people certainly are exercised about the issue. For anyone who hasn't heard of the topic, what it is several universities, and let's see, there's a handy dandy list here in one of our links. Santa Barbara, in the wake of their shooting, I actually don't know if their discussion of this was tied to the shooting or was going on before. Rutgers, Oberlin, and George Washington University have called for trigger warnings on their syllabi and courses that deal with potentially triggering material, according to the New York Times, I guess, broke this. So this has caused, you know, on the one hand, people saying, yes, this is good. You know, people who have suffered from traumatic events that could have their entire psyches upended by being exposed to that material again. They should at least have some notice that that's coming their way. And at the same time, folks on the assigning side of the equation are going, hold on, you know, what exactly do you want us to give trigger warnings about? Because that's what universities and other academic institutions are for, to assign things that are provocative that we can discuss and that teach us something about society and ourselves. So it's been very controversial, and the funny silver lining of it all is the National Association of Scholars actually held a trigger warning contest, encouraging people to write in with the funniest trigger warnings they could think of for various works out there, including some examples that they gave when they announced the contest. The Iliad warning, disturbing scene for those suffering sports injuries. Things along those lines. So what do you guys think about trigger warnings? Good, bad, in a case like Corey's, maybe better than the alternative?
I think it's easy to make fun of. And I certainly have never seen trigger warnings in an academic context per se. And, you know, I think, you know, this is not as big an issue, I think, as it's portrayed to be, but underlying it is kind of the evidence of some serious social change. I mean, I would like to think we're becoming a more and more compassionate society, and we certainly, I think empirically, are welcoming more and more people into our community of equals. And that necessarily is going to have, I think, some friction that goes along with it, where, you know, people in those different groups are going to have experiences which are damaging in a way that the majority has, you know, not appreciated before. And I guess the essence of being a privileged majority is that there are all kinds of experiences in life that you kind of don't have to think about. As a male, I don't think twice about walking across campus at 11 o'clock at night. I don't fear for my safety all the time. And that's just not true of a lot of, especially young women on our campus. So there are lots of things they think about that I don't have to think about. Now, that said, I think it's a nice thing to do and a compassionate thing to do to warn people if there's a, you know, a violent rape scene in a book that you're going to discuss. It seems to me not unreasonable to say, to kind of flag that, especially if it comes up unexpectedly. Mandating it is a different thing, trying to avoid it. Rape is an element of our society. We're trying to expunge it as much as we can. So I don't think it's a topic to be avoided, or censored. But I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with warning people that it's going to come up. I think there may be something wrong with mandating that everything has to be labeled for every particular sensitive group. I don't know. It's kind of a rambling answer, but there's a silly side to this and a somewhat more difficult side. And I think the whole label of trigger warnings kind of trivializes the more difficult problems.
Evan, I keep coming back to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and the Communications Decency Act in general, much of which does not exist anymore, maybe all of which except for Section 230. I'm not quite clear on that. But this whole notion in the law of encouraging people to do good things and not penalizing them should they fail to do good things. And that tension comes up for me in thinking about trigger warnings. I don't want teachers, professors to be penalized because they, and no pun intended, please, people, because they choose not to to give a warning in a certain situation, but they do in others. Right. Am I making sense with where I'm going there?
Yeah, and I think that plays in very well with what Christian was saying about it's one question to consider whether it's nice and it's compassionate and it's a polite thing to do to give a warning that there may be some content or episode in this literary work that may be offending to certain sensibilities. And another question altogether to mandate it, because once you put that mandate in place, the failure to meet that mandate in the natural course of things gives rise to liability and the basis to ostracize and to have professors lose their tenure and all these, parade of things in this parade of horribles here. So, just to also sort of knock the ball on something that Christian teed up here, it's very easy to make fun of this. And I'll go ahead and take the bait. Yeah, I'll make fun of it. You know, mandating a trigger warning thing is incredibly stupid. It's because we're on this spectrum that leads only in one direction to absurdity. It's the same spectrum that we see that we have all these product warning labels because of the active plaintiff's bar for personal injury. You see incredibly ridiculous warnings on certain products that warning this coffee is hot. You're kidding, right? So, I mean, with this, if we're going to, regulate or set up a system where there's no alternative except to give these types of warnings, put this type of metadata on a piece of work, on a literary work or whatever type of content it is you're consuming there, where do you stop? It's a slippery slope, I guess, because everybody's got a certain sensibility, and it's just that you would have no way of taking the whole range of different people's sensibilities into consideration when doing something like this. So you'll just get this absurd result that's either going to inevitably be incomplete or be so overly comprehensive that the trigger warnings are longer than the Iliad itself. So that's pretty silly.
But, I think as bad an idea as mandating it may be for the reasons that have been stated, I think it's a good idea to encourage people like me, an educator, to say, give some thought. If the stuff that you've assigned in your syllabus, if there's anything in here that if you took the time to think about it, you might want to flag for people as an unexpected place where they might encounter something that is could remind them of a traumatic experience. And that's a good idea for me to think about. I welcome someone reminding me that I could take the opportunity to think about that. I mean, now, having said that, as someone who teaches patent law, as someone who teaches antitrust law and those sorts of things, I'm not likely to encounter in my syllabus those kinds of materials. But maybe one of the reasons I feel okay about it is because I don't think it's going to have much bite in my day-to-day existence. But I do think it makes sense to ask educators, give it some thought. Maybe there is something you want to flag. And a good thing about flagging it could be that it signals to students that you are thoughtful about this kind of thing. And Denise's point about the value of bringing these things out into the open so that we can talk about them and engage with them in a productive way. Well, the flag warning can be a way to say, hey, I'm open to talking about it. I recognize it's an issue. So yeah. I think it could be helpful.
But come on, isn't that what you're supposed to, isn't that what the substance of the course is usually about? I mean, what is the, Where's the distinction between this hand wringing that underlies about trigger warnings versus actually talking about how the rape scene fits into the overall literary tool? What's the meaningful distinction?
The distinction is simply that with anything rich enough to teach from, there's probably an almost infinite number of things that you could emphasize. So you can't emphasize everything. You have to highlight some things and lowlight some other things. And so you're making choices. And it's just a way for you to signal what some of your choices are. I don't think anyone should hand-wring about any of this. I think people should just engage with it. And this is just another way to engage. At least that's how it strikes me.
I mean, I think, when you teach and a significant number of students, one thing you learn pretty early on is there's always someone in the room who has some experience with respect to the hypothetical that you're working from, especially in law where we deal in lots of hypotheticals. There, in a class of 100 people, you know, there's going to be someone whose brother just died or whose mom died last year or who has been sexually assaulted or has been burglarized. And not taking account of that and being at least sensitive to the fact that this is going to be hard for some people. It's easy in the abstract, I think, just like, you know, being, you know, it's easy in the abstract to want to throw the book at criminals in the abstract. And sometimes people get really frustrated with juries who seemingly let people off too easily. But the juries are the people in the room looking at the actual person. And as a teacher, you're in the room looking at the actual students who may have come and told you that they've had these experiences, traumatic in one way or the other. And but the distinction I would make is that the, you know, the name for a professor who, you know, makes a somewhat careless and unthoughtful hypothetical about rape in order to make a certain point, that person's kind of a jerk. But I don't know that they've done anything. You know, I don't think we should say they've done anything illegal, because, you know, we have to, that way lies madness, you know, for the same ways that, right. For the same reasons you guys have said. But it's a very different thing in the abstract to think that giving a warning or being sensitive about a topic is, you know, too politically correct or too far down the road of the nanny state. It's very different to do that than it is to actually be in the room with people that you've talked to who have had these traumatic experiences and realizing that you have an obligation to teach them in a way that meets their needs. And that way is not necessarily to avoid any discussion of things which they've had personal traumatic experience with, but to do so in a way that they can learn from and that maybe also helps others realize that, this has to be done in a sensitive way. So I'm not averse to that as a norm, but I think like the rest of you as a law, you know, I think that's maybe going too far.
And at that point, I just don't. I agree with you, Christian. You know, from what I hear you saying is just essentially just try to be a decent person and have
exactly
basic sense of respect and politeness. And so yeah, making it a law again, I just think is really. Kind of incredible here, because if you do actually make it a law, and I think I'm just repeating what I said earlier, there's nowhere to go except absurdity with this, because unless it really is going to be, you know, fully comprehensive, like, you know, if there's, you know, content about, and I don't want to make it too controversial, but I mean, a religious sensibility, say you have a Jewish person in the class and there's a story that just mentions Islam, you know, or, you know, if there's, you know, Muslim students in the class and it mentions Christianity, the Crusades, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, how on earth can you comprehensively get that done? I think the only way of doing it is, you know, in a meaningful way, which I think is what you're suggesting, Christian, of just sort of having general common sense and human courtesy, respect of dignity of persons that you're interacting with.
Yeah, and you're pointing at kind of two dimensions of the problem. Like, you know, one of them is, you know, what kinds of things do we think are ridiculous for people to be sensitive about? You know, what kinds of things should people be exposed to, even though they would rather not? And, you know, a Jewish student who doesn't want to be exposed to any information about Islam, you know, it's a somewhat absurd example, but, you know, in the law, we deal with absurd examples all the time. That's one where you can say, okay, if you really want to be cloistered away from any information about another religion, this is, you know, this university is not the place for you, because that's not what we do here. That's one dimension of the problem. But I think it's a very different dimension to say that, you know, anyone who's been raped is going to have a visceral emotional reaction to especially, you know, vivid discussions involving rape. That's very human and a reaction which is totally compatible with being a student in a university. And I think, you know, it's very tricky as a professor to figure out how to kind of hew the line and figure out what you're going to kind of what difficult issues you're going to kind of push on the students to think about and which issues, you know, maybe you need a lighter touch. But the very fact that that's such a difficult decision and a difficult art, you know, counsels against any kind of law, which I don't think any of us is advocating.
Yeah.
Can I share a personal example that might show that this issue can come up in some unexpected places?
Of course.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things we have to do as law professors is write exams. And in the traditional law school exam, you create these fact patterns and students have to analyze the facts using the legal rules that they've learned. And so one challenge for me as someone who teaches patent law and who wants to welcome into the class people who have all kinds of different levels of technological education, including very little technological education, because, you know, for a patent litigator, you don't need to have a technical background. If you find science and technology fun and interesting, patent law could be something you could really thrive in as a litigator, as I was. I was not a patent prosecutor. I was a patent litigator. So I'm always on the lookout for technologies in recent patents that people across the full range of experience will be able to understand. So in other words, I often wind up using simple mechanical inventions for my exam questions. And a few years ago, there was this really fun and interesting patent, and there's a bunch of technology actually in this area because it's something that is pervasive in human life. And it was about a casket system that you put the dead body in the casket and you align the system so that the person
Wait, you didn't tell me you were going to talk about this.
Right, exactly. I hope no one's experienced a death in the family recently.
Right. I knew somebody who died once. Okay, sorry.
Right. No, but this is the point. So this great casket patent, which shows, you know, it has the outlines of the bodies in the casket. The caskets are put, the invention was about orienting the casket so that the person is basically standing underground instead of laying down underground.
God, Joe.
Yeah, there were a bunch of other things about it too. But so there were these images of dead bodies in casket, not gruesome images, outlines, you know, stick figure type outlines. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, you know, wow, this is really understandable. It's really fun. But I decided not to use it. And I decided not to use it for the reason of the joke Evan just made, which is, you know, if I've got to give an exam, and that's a very stressful experience. And having someone who just lost a family member thinking about that while they're trying to take my patent exam, they don't need that aggravation in their life. And I can avoid creating it very easily by just doing something else. So I did. And I
But you totally perfect. Would you totally would have talked about that in class, though, right? I mean, it's a close judgment call because during exams, students are all keyed up and you want them just to show what they know and do their best and something which is for some students so emotionally, you know, you don't want that to enter into it, right? But during class, you know, be appropriate, I think.
So even though it's highly improbable that there is someone in the room who had a family member die recently, although it's highly improbable, for the person for whom it is actually true, it will be really bad. So just avoid it. It's easy, right? And so it's the kind of thing where as an educator, I'm just making Christian's point in a different way. So if you're trying to be a decent, compassionate person with common sense, you're not going to have 999 out of 1,000 of these issues because you're thinking it through and you're going to do great.
I'm glad I'm not a law professor because I try too hard to be funny. I wouldn't be able to give up teaching the funny patent about the standing corpses because someone might be sensitive to it. I think I'd just forge ahead.
No, you would teach it. It's totally okay. It's totally okay to teach that, I think. I might not teach that if I had a student who came in very upset after the death of, say, a sibling the day before. You know, that might give me pause, but... You know, we talk, you know, I do classes, we talk about sex and we talk about death and I don't teach anything where we talk about sexual assault, but you know, these things have to be talked about and you can even be funny about them, but you have to do so in a way that is, I think, you know, sensitive. Like Joe says, it's kind of common sense, you know, don't be a jerk. And you want people also to listen generously, just like you're talking generously. And it's tricky. It's like the rest of life, you know. being a decent person is not always, you know, it's you just try your best.
It's great because you could use that standing coffin thing in a real property course as well, because you could fit a lot more bodies on Blackacre than
absolutely.
they were you, laying.
You can. You, you could just pack them in there.
Right. At least three or four times as many.
That's hysterical. All right. Well, Joe, just, you know, bear in mind, there are a lot of people out there who've been scarred by patent trolls and copyright trolls. So, you know, don't think you're safe as an IP law professor. Before we leave this topic, I think we should give the winners of the National Association of Scholars a trigger warning contest. They picked three. Here they are. The trigger warning for Lolita. disturbing novel. Narrator does not recycle. Number two, the warning for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Warning, may contain nuts. And finally, and this is my favorite, green eggs and ham glorifies GMOs. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of funny ones. There are some honorable mentions and some that their staff made up that they just could not resist putting on the site, even though they're not giving out prizes for them. This one's good. Confessions of St. Augustine, narrow-minded treatment of Carthaginian hookup culture. That's good. So go check those out at nas.org. Let's make glorifies GMOs our second passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you are listening for MCLE or other professional education credit, and let me just write it down so I don't forget it.
Or if you're playing GMOs. This Week in Law bingo.
That's right.
You know, if you have that on your square, you know.
Bing, bing, bing.
I won't say drinking game because no one does that. This is bingo. Just bingo.
Right. Bingo. Let's talk about, we were touching on this with our story about the HathiTrust case and how people's access to the law and analysis of the law and the traditional role of lawyers in society is changing in response to technology. One thing that has been in the news for the last week or so, Wired did a story on Ravel, which I'm happy to remind folks was our resource of the week back in November of last year on episode 234. If you want to hear more about Ravel, you can go re-listen to that episode. But Ravel was written up in Wired. And for those who didn't listen to episode 234, it's this really cool legal visualization tool that if you go to ravellaw.com, you can run a few searches and see. It gives you sort of a graphic scattering of how much information in response to your query comes up over time. It's really fun to play with. I put in a search for cell tower data before the show and got a lot of interesting things. I think it's a great example of how you might, hopefully you will find exactly what you were looking for that's on point, but you will also find a lot of stuff you may not have known you were looking for. Great use of serendipity in search. And the Wired piece interviews the founders and talks about, and this was really funny to me, how one of them had been an intern in a family law firm years before they had gone to law school and were appalled to learn when they started using modern legal research tools that nothing had changed in the intervening years. People were still using the same tools, doing the same things, and they both decided that needed to change. So Ravel is out there to change how you think about the law, visualize the law. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean, once you start applying machine learning and big data to the conundrum that is trying to both locate and then analyze and then apply legal principles, you wind up with some serious alterations to the way law has been taught and practiced in the past. So I thought we had a great panel of folks to discuss this topic. In fact, Christian has written an incredible piece over at the Hydrotext blog that we referenced called The Information Law Crisis that is all about this. So why don't we start with you, Christian?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing work on law and information in a couple of different areas. And you know, that piece was about how the law that we have is ill-adapted to what's valuable. I mean, a lot of what law does is to protect value, assign value, make clear line, you know, property lines. And we take a lot of those lines for granted, which is why in property class, sometimes we'll start with whether we own our bodies and what does it mean to own something. And it turns out it's much more complicated than a lot of people suspect, you know, initially. So what the law does is it creates those kinds of lines. And like I said, we take a lot of them for granted. But a lot of the problems that we see today, I think, are just ill-suited, or the law is ill-suited to aim at them. And one of the ways I kind of motivate that little blog post is by just noting that, you know, the phone that you carry around, you know, you may be valuable to you. They're certainly valuable, but all of the information on that phone, if it were to disappear, if it weren't backed up, may be a lot more valuable to you than the thing which holds that information. You know, the information on a computer, if it isn't backed up or if you only have a few backups, is in some sense irreplaceable. The computer can totally be replaced. And you see this throughout law, whether it's privacy from corporations or from the government. You have other topics in the rundown which touch on these same topics. The law is having a really hard time figuring out what is valuable to people. What does privacy mean in a world where we think it extends beyond the walls of your home or your car, where it's possible to detect where people are all the time, where it's possible to track what they're doing on the web. So that's kind of one aspect. And that was the main point of that blog post, is just that the law isn't really aimed at there's a mismatch between what people consider valuable today and what people considered valuable and worth incentivizing at the time that the law we have developed. But there's a more general point here. It's kind of what I'm, you know, my bigger project now is if you think about it, law is a computer itself. Law is a distributed mechanism for computing information. And you have information flowing among institutions, whether it's legislatures, the president, administrative agencies, courts. They all are in the business of taking in information and processing it and sending it out again. So in terms of just legal philosophy, I think there's a real advancement to be made in understanding law in kind of informational theoretical terms. And then there's the other piece I don't have in front of me, and my memory's terrible, which has pointed out this new initiative of visualizing cases is emblematic of it, that are just a increasing ability to manipulate information and process it cheaply is already working and will continue to work. And information in law's practice, you know, how we go about actually doing on a day-to-day basis what we conceive of as the law, and that's going to change. So, I think the informational perspective is I think really hits on all three of those areas: law's practice, law's design, and law's basic philosophy.
Do you think that as you were talking through, it occurred to me that maybe the problem that you identify in your piece, the fact that a lot of our laws were built up, as you say, to draw compromise lines in a world of skilled labor, consolidated media companies, ample self-help opportunities to preserve privacy, and very limited means of mass distribution of intellectual works, with those things no longer being true, is having law be a more effective computer the answer to that problem, to have it respond more in real time to the norms that are current then?
Yeah, I mean, you know, law evolves, you know, in some ways we can work around the edges and we can change individual laws and it's adaptive in that way. But in a lot of ways, you know, on the broader perspective, it's a really kind of clunky mechanism because there's a lot of updating that needs to occur. A lot of people, I think me included, think we should basically get rid of patent law. The copyright law, you know, the best research out there is that it should last for about 15 or 16 years and not life of the author plus 70 or 95 years. So we have a lot of problems which have developed because we've conceived of protection of ideas and information too analogously to physical goods. At a time when that law was developed to protect physical goods and land, when those were the most valuable assets, and where, you know, so long as we protected your ownership of your home, we protected your livelihood, because you could make your money off of your land. And law went through a crisis when the Industrial Revolution upended that, when most people who, you know, lived in cities or suburban areas were workers who were more or less interchangeable, and housing and land for them was just the place where they lived, and it was a commodity, could be anywhere. So we saw some, you know, major updates in the laws governing landlords and what they had to provide. There was a time where if you were renting a place and the whole place burned down, you were still on the hook to pay rent. Or if something broke, it was on you to fix it. And a lot of that's been updated as people are living, people are essentially consuming housing services rather than arable land to farm. And that took a long time. And worker protections, you know, you can debate the minimum wage, but, you know, there's certainly a bunch of workplace safety regulations and the minimum wage, other things which were, you know, maybe perceived as more necessary and are more necessary in a world where workers are a factor of production and industrial processes. And these days, you know, we're all, you know, lots of us are producing informational goods. A lot of what's valuable in our lives today are informational goods. You know, there are our photos, our music, the writing we do or the writing, you know, that we consume. These are the valuable things, perhaps even more so than land. The law is not responding to that. You know, copyright is, like I said, terribly long. It makes it really hard to use the cultural raw materials we have to engage in the most valuable form of production that we have today, which is the transformation of information.
Is there a point, though, yeah, when the question has to become, though, is the reason that the law isn't responding to that is because of the mechanism by which the law is enacted and enforced? And I'm not trying to indict the American way of life and, you know, the way that the democracy works and all that stuff. But what I'm really trying to indict here is special interests affecting the legislative process in a way that's not appropriate.
Well, that, I mean, that's clearly, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I was going to say that's clearly the lesson that Larry Lessig took from the Eldred loss, right? Is that, you know, that was that the copyright extension was a clear giveaway to big media companies like Disney. It was the Supreme Court opinion, but all the Economist papers make clear that the value in terms of spurring innovation was zero for that extension. I mean, you know, statistically zero. And so it was only really explained as a benefit to existing copyright holders and existing valuable copyright holders or holders of valuable copyrights. In the blog post that I mentioned earlier, you know, one lesson he took was that he couldn't help the justices understand why it was so valuable, right? Why the public domain was valuable and why insults to the public domain were so harmful to society. But I think at the same time, he took the lesson that this corrupt legislative system, we can't rely on courts for everything. We rely on our legislatures to legislate in the public interest, and that clearly failed here. And I think he over time saw that as a deeper and deeper sickness within American society. And now he's got this new PAC and he's trying to do all sorts of things to make progress on the legislative front rather than relying on the courts as kind of heroes, because they won't always be. And I think both things are right. I think that law on the judicial front is somewhat slow to change, because that process of, you know, we talked about this earlier in the show, of getting people really to feel that, you know, a larger public domain, a shorter copyright period, that is valuable to them in their everyday lives, that this is something to be feared. That's a long process. You know, certainly people of many of, especially the retired justices generation, they weren't uploading a bunch of YouTubes, I don't think. I don't think they were making their own podcasts. And I think actually you can look back to the Sony Betamax case for another example of this. People forget that it was the vote of a single justice was between us and a world in which it was basically illegal to make the VCR. And in the dissenting opinion in that case, the ones who would have said that this was an infringing product, for them, you know, they said, look, the difference here is, you know, they pointed to totally okay activities like clipping out newspaper, you know, making newspaper clippings and sending them to friends to put on their bulletin boards. And to me, the kind of common thread between that and what we saw in Eldred is that people have reactions to the value of public domain and copyright that reflect what they're already doing in their lives. And copyright was not infringing on activities that the justices engaged in, right? Which was not, you know, recording primetime TV shows on their home VCRs, but it was, you know, a typical maybe Supreme Court justice activity, clipping out newspaper columns and sending them to friends, which so I really think there is a long period of adjustment that has to occur as more people take advantage of and are involved in things which are butting up against the sharp edge of the maladjusted laws that we have.
Yeah, I keep waiting for the Supreme Court and staff to do the ultimate lip dub of Pharrell's Happy, but yeah.
And I was just actually, you know, I was just talking to Dahlia Lithwick this morning about this. Because what she was saying, she objected to the idea. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I agree with it. So I'll just adopt this as my own. That it's not that the justices don't understand technology. I just don't want to take credit for this observation, but it's not that they don't understand technology, because by the time they decide the cases and have gone through the briefs and the clerks, I think they understand it well enough. You know, maybe not as well as true nerds, and you know, I admit to being a big nerd, but maybe not as well as people who work in the field or who are constantly geeking out on this stuff. But they understand it probably well enough to render legal judgments. What they don't do, though, is feel the value of these things. And a lot of judging is weighing competing values. You know, whether we like it or not, and I think it's unavoidable. Judging in these kinds of cases, whether it's copyright or other areas of interest to IP people, or any other area, is about choosing between possibilities which are in fact open, and that's a value judgment. So,
and if I could jump in at that point, because I think it's important to, in Denise's comment before about, you know, can we make the law more efficient? How can we do that? In a way, it's the law is in part it's found, but in part it's made, and it may even be that in more significant part it's made, so that we discover part of how we discover what we value is by going through the process of trying to create a legal regime that reflects it. And so there you can't rush people through that process of figuring out, based on their daily life and experiences, what they care about. They have to have those experiences, and it sort of emerges from those experiences.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think, it's a really interesting thing to talk about. I don't think there are any easy solutions to the disconnect that Christian identifies in his piece.
Let me jump in.
Go ahead.
I think that one thing that moves the needle is a bunch of people breaking the law. So there's actually a pretty rich and increasingly rich literature on the value of people breaking the law. It's Sonia Kotyal and Eduardo Peñalvar wrote an influential book called Property Outlaws, which is one, maybe a key element of this genre, which just shows that this is always, maybe always is too strong, but has often been a way that the law has changed, is by people breaking it. We have adverse possession and property law, which a lot of students are surprised to hear exists. This is where, you can trespass. If you trespass long enough and flagrantly enough, eventually the property you're trespassing on can become yours legally, which is somewhat surprising to people. And so too, I think the Napster era changed things. People's expectations about what they can do, the anger against DMCA takedown notices. People constantly agitating at the edges and transgressing legal norms is what changes them. There has to be a critical mass of that kind of desire, that kind of, like I said, it's people kind of brushing up against and hitting and sometimes passing through the sharp edge of the law that causes us to think, maybe the problem is not the people here, it's the law we have.
So, and that would be true even if there weren't, as there are, as Evan pointed out, even if there weren't interest groups agitating constantly for their own preferred outcomes, the things that Christian just described would be happening. And moreover, there are some of these issues like the cell phone data from the tower and getting a search warrant. There's some issues that it's not really presented in the interest group conflict way that a copyright statute that extends copyright term is presented. A court has to decide, well, does the Fourth Amendment require a warrant for that or not? That's not something lobbyists are going to be, well, maybe, I suppose they could. People who make phones might have a lobby position that relates to that. But I think in search and seizure, it hasn't worked out that way. It's been more a province of the courts. But the interest group problem, as big as it is not the entire story.
Right. And I guess we're all progressing perhaps toward the day when we had James Barrett on the show not too long ago, and he writes about super intelligent artificial intelligence systems. and their pros and cons, mostly cons or risks. But, you know, at some point, if we're going to look at the pro side of that, you know, our laws do such a hack sometimes of, as you've pointed out, Christian, actually bringing current values into conformity with the laws that are on the books or vice versa. That it's some sort of AI might do a whole lot better job. I mean, one of the articles in our rundown here is this very fascinating piece about machines versus lawyers and how the legal profession is getting disrupted. I think here the parallel to, you know, people affecting change through breaking the law here is people affecting change of the legal profession by simply rebelling against, you know, how they're able to receive legal services, the price that they have to pay and what they actually get for their money. I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that. And the article highlights five areas most ripe for disruption. You know, these are all very discrete things. I think we would all agree. Yeah, you know, the law is kind of broken there and technology could help. Discovery, search, legal forms, simple briefs and memos, and, you know, query what's simple enough to let a machine handle. And then hunch-based decision-making, and I guess that's the biggie, right, where you're putting big data into the equation and potentially an AI to crunch it and decide, okay, we've got all these variables and what's going to be the right outcome here. So, you know, I think... maybe we shouldn't be too leery of our robot overlords when it comes to the law, I guess is what I'm aiming at here. What do you think, Evan?
When you say not being too leery of them, are you saying because of their capacity to maybe do the right things in some instances?
To maybe get it better than we've been able to get it ourselves up to this point.
I mean, we can certainly see pretty easily how that is a positive because, you know, we're subject to human foible and subject to the pressures of time, of the pressures of attention, the pressures of political influence, bribery, what have you, all the things that could corrupt the integrity of the legislative process, of the judicial process, of the advocacy process, you know, all of the different, I guess, software applications that are running in this computer that is the law, to stay with Christian's metaphor here. So yes, that, I mean, it could be a pure form, but you know, this, it all just gets down to me with sort of fundamental questions of what it is we're trying to accomplish here. Yeah. When I say that, I mean, you know, us as human beings organizing ourselves into society, a culture where we have collectively decided, or it was decided for us when the Republic was established, you know, to go about governing ourselves in this way, you know, governing, you know, putting restrictions, making decisions, you know, putting ourselves in certain categories of conduct that is acceptable, outside of which is not acceptable and is subject to liability or criminal culpability or what have you here. So it becomes the fundamental question of, is this the way we want to do it? Do we want to turn it over to machines? Because yeah, it's great in terms of the efficiencies that would be gained. And you know, you can almost hear the collective cheer of the vox populi when they would, you know, hear that, oh, you don't have to deal with lawyers as much anymore. You know, that's just, isn't that a win-win for everybody? Well, sure, right? But you know, when you get a notice from the IRS that you owe you know, so such and such dollars in back taxes, and the decision was made to do that, to send that notice to you, and the enforceability of all that whole process is done with being about it, you know, is that the kind of society that we want to live in, where it is, where we have just turned things over? Because it's all good when we think of the positive aspects of it, the efficiencies, the speed, you know, all that stuff. But when, you know, when it comes to that point where we're pressing up against the edges of that box that governs us or that is legislating us, I mean, not to get too pedagogical or whatever, but, or you know, to get into the etymology of, I just said pedagogical and there's two professors on the show, you know, you know, the law and, you know, the idea of legislation is the same root word as, you know, ligaments, you know, to bind or to, you know, to tie us to certain concepts here. It's not very pleasant when, you know, we're stretching those things that bind us and all that stuff. And at that point, I just don't know that anybody wants to be subject to the whims. Well, let's not say whims, but the determination, the decisions of a machine system in those situations. It would always be nice to know that you can appeal to a human. Wouldn't that be right? Wouldn't you? Always be nice to have a person.
That's really great. I want to pick up on that. Because, I mean, and this previews some of the stuff I'm working on. But you know, one of the most famous law review articles I've ever written, you know, starts by saying the fundamental thing law does is to decide in a situation in which two people have conflicting desires, which shall prevail. I mean, that's ultimately, you know, if no one's ever fighting, you don't need law. But when two people in a society want something which conflicts with the other, they both can't win and you have to make a decision. And that decision, that social decision that we make is basically the name that we give to the law. And I think that, you know, fundamentally, law is an apparatus. It's a sea of institutions exchanging information. And the fundamental thing that we do in that system is to push to one of those institutions or sometimes create a shared system. But ultimately, someone has to decide that question, who shall win. There's an irreducible political decision which has to be made to resolve any dispute. And perhaps you can give that to a long dead legislature. You say, oh, they've made the decision. The decision has been made. Maybe you decide that through the common law method, this is the kind of thing that a court should make on an instantaneous basis using data from other decisions before and maybe some legislative policy. Or you could decide, I'm frozen there. Am I still on? Okay, yeah. Or you could decide that we're just going to wait on the legislature. So there are lots of institutions which can make these decisions. But the point is that to resolve any case, you've got to make a decision between open alternatives. And law sometimes complicates our understanding of that basic obligation, I think, to its detriment. But we have to keep in mind that's what's going on. So the machines, maybe we could give them the authority to make those decisions. But I think they'll be, you know, most effective, at least in the short run, at helping cut through the complexity and helping institutions communicate better. But it's harder to see that they would be making that irreducible political decision. For instance, you know, one of the examples that article uses is some people want to make noise and some people want quiet, right? Maybe I want to have a loud party. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And my neighbor wants peace and quiet at night. Both of those things can't happen at the same time. It's somewhat of a tragedy that we're located next to each other in that scenario. But there we are. And we have to make a decision. So the law has to decide whether to privilege quiet or partying and in what measure, at what times. And there's a political decision to be made there. And no matter how you obscure that, if you say, well, we are compelled by this statute, which is 100 years old, to decide in this way, that's fine. But you've recognize that what the law has done is to privilege the preferences of a 100-year-old legislature there. The decision is still being made by people. And no matter what you do, that decision will be made by people. So I think that's I think I agree with Evan. I think it's, I would be uncomfortable with, and I think it's almost a category mistake to think that the machines can make that decision. But as with everything else that the internet has made better, I think one thing it can make better is the way we communicate, allowing ordinary people to participate in the life of the law and to participate in law's kind of resolution function without going through expensive lawyers. I think that's a good thing. And I think it would force kind of our definition and understanding of lawyer to change in a very positive way. You know, as I would love to see lawyers evolve into just general problem solvers and translators, because nothing we do is going to make conflict go away. People are going to have competing desires. And lawyers are an easy kind of target to point our fingers at because they are representing people who are fighting. And so they, you know, they embody conflict. But that's not the only way we could organize ourselves. We could do it differently. And I'm kind of excited to see what that will be. And especially how the network and computing resources will, you know, shepherd that along.
It's just going to be a hardwired ontology of trigger warnings. That's how we solve the problems.
Yeah, I hope not. I hope not.
You know, an issue that's sort of separate from what Christian's been talking about is and that but has to operate with it, is there's, you know, where does the rule come from? But there's the difference between stating a rule and applying a rule to a given set of facts, and that's what strikes me as incongruous about the notion that that AI could take care of all of the issues we have. I think what it would do is it would change the boundary, the location of the boundary between hard cases and easy cases. But there will always be hard cases because there will always be instances where the rule is either on the under-inclusive side or the over-inclusive side, a bad fit for the set of facts that have now been brought forward in a given dispute. And that's where human judgment will always be required, because it's other humans that are going to see, well, this was the reason we have the rule. That reason informs what we do in the situation where the rule doesn't fit very well with the facts. And so, you know, in the sense in which all rules have this unwritten thing at the end of them that says, you know, unless it would be absurd to apply this rule, that's where we come in. If in no other place, we come in where we have to apply that unwritten caveat at the end.
The thing is, well, by the time we recognize that we've got to step in there, it will be too late. And I'm only sort of saying this in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way. I'm sort of subscribing to a James Barrett view of the future here, where it could be kind of sinister if we allow AI to play such a role in making those decisions and, you know, drawing a distinction between the easier cases and the hard cases or whatever. At a certain point, the AI is going to become so intelligent that it'll become self-aware, self-referential, and then start directing the law in such a way that it will look out for its own rights and its own consciousness. And I'm putting that in air quotes because phenomenologically, it doesn't matter whether it's real consciousness like what we experience or just a machine consciousness that passes the Turing test and all that. The point is, if we get past a point, you know, past the singularity where the law or machines are putting too much of an influence, they're going to start looking out for their own interests and then just recognize that we are better as nutritive value than as agents for which they should be concerned in their decision-making process. Wait,
can I try something maybe concrete, although, you know, constitutional issue, which let's imagine we haven't yet reached the singularity. There's still stuff for people to do. So we have an equal protection clause in the Constitution, right? So, no state can deny equal protection of the laws. And what does that mean? It means everybody has to be treated equally. And you can do some funny things with parsing textually what equal protection of the laws means versus just equality. But ultimately, you know, it seems to be a kind of equality mandate. And yet it can't mean everything that it says, because the very nature of the law is to make distinctions. You know, every law treats people unequally. The law against murder treats murderers particularly badly, right? But not in a way that we think is offensive or offends what we think is really behind the equal protection clause. So what does that mean? Well, what does the equal protection clause mean? Well, it means kind of what we've said it means in an over 100 year now elaboration of that principle and rethinking the principle of equality that was embedded there and turning it over. That is, you know, that's one of the jobs of lawyers and judges, to help us make in a judicial context, because we think this is the kind of decision which is better made in a judicial type institution than in a legislative one. And I can bracket whether everybody agrees with that or not, but, to decide to reach this ultimately political question, which groups are in the community of equals with respect to this law? And I think that is irreducibly political. And when it's argued, like gay rights and gay marriage, I think that what we see is not a discovery of that the Equal Protection Clause is always meant to protect gay marriage or to protect gay rights. I don't think that's even sensible. I think that what we see is a social evolution toward understanding that gay people as a category are among the community of equals and are entitled to equal treatment. And the clause's principles reach that group. And that's a political determination, but one that we make in the courts. And then you start to understand that law is about deciding what kinds of institutions should make what kinds of decisions. And we can argue about whether the court or legislature should make those kinds of decisions about who's in and who's out of the community of equals. But that, you know, it's hard to imagine, you know, where is a machine, how is a machine going to help with that basic question?
Well, Floop in IRC, I think, has nailed it because he or she has managed to mash up Game of Thrones, I Choose Trial by Combat with Real Steel, and thinks we should just have BattleBots resolve everything, all disputes.
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil anything, but I watched the Game of Thrones episode that features that, and that seems maybe not the greatest way. At least I won't be a lawyer in that system, I think I can say.
If people can't even feel uniformly good about arbitration, how on earth are they going to feel good about something like that? You know,
arbitration, fascinating topic.
Yes. All right, let's go out before we get to our tip and resource of the week and fork over our air here to other shows. I'm going to just mention, because we don't have much time to discuss, but they're both newsworthy events, that Tesla has taken a non-patent enforcement approach. Elon Musk has basically been his own Ronald Reagan to his own Gorbachev and said, bring down this wall. And taken
That's
down
good.
Their patent
That's
wall.
Good.
Yay.
Yay. So basically saying we're not going to enforce, I guess this is what he means, we're not going to enforce our patents anymore. We've got a bunch of them, and we think that we want competition in this area to thrive. So have at it. So good for Elon. It made me think of, I know we talked about last year, Evan, the Twitter approach towards its engineers and designers patents and how it wants to make people in that position keep more control over the patents that they work on. Right. And they call that the IPA.
It's very
not, hoppy. Yes, very hoppy. The innovators patent agreement. So just another great and probably more public example of people taking a more open source approach toward their intellectual property. Joe, I'm sure we could do a whole show on this with you. any quick comment before I mention our other newsy item I don't want people to ignore from the week?
Well, just, two quick things. One, the I would encourage folks to go read the very short blog post that Elon Musk, where he makes a statement, because mm-hmm. there's one interesting caveat in it, which is that he says we won't enforce them against people who in good faith want to use the patented technology. That phrase, in good faith, it's not clear to me what that means.
Yeah.
And so time will tell. Time will tell what it means. I'm sure people will ask him. I'm sure that in the company, it's a publicly traded company, it will have to make SEC filings. Maybe they'll make some comments that shed some light on that. The other quick thing is simply that this example, you mentioned open source, a great phrase that people know. A newer phrase to try to get at some of this stuff is called patent pledges. And that's basically what this is. It's a non-enforcement pledge for his patents, but it's not in a standard setting body. It's simply Tesla's desire to make its technology more widely available to try to leverage network effects. And there's a law professor named George Contreras at American University Law School who's doing really interesting new work on this field of patent pledges. So I would encourage folks to, if they're interested, to just go look for George's papers. And once again, George Contreras, and he's doing really interesting stuff with this.
Great. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention, because I know it's an issue near and dear to our viewers and listeners' hearts, is there was an important 11th Circuit federal appellate court decision on not being able to access cell tower data without a warrant, finding that a cell site location, body of cell site location information is within the subscriber's reasonable expectation of privacy, and obtaining that data without a warrant would be a Fourth Amendment violation. Now, this is the 11th Circuit, which applies to only a small bit of the United States, but obviously this is important that a federal appellate court has found this. Jennifer Granick, the head of civil liberties at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society, points out why it's so important. She writes that because the ruling involves stored cell site data, it undermines the NSA's phone metadata collection program, which the government has argued is allowed because customers relinquish their right to privacy when it comes to a company's business records. So she goes on to write that the ruling found that the defendant in this case had an expectation of privacy, despite the fact that the cell data was also the company's business record. So it could be important in that whole constitutionality of surveillance discussion. Just another piece of the puzzle there to keep an eye on. So let's move on to our tip and resource of the week. Our resource, we're just going to go, I'm not going to play it for you because we've already gone long today, but I am going to point you towards the trailer for The Internet's Own Boy. I know that folks are watching for this to come out. It's been at Sundance and Cannes and is obviously very emotional and tied to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and its application. So go watch the trailer and look for the film. It looks like it's well done just based on the trailer. That's, you know, obviously on a sad and tragic note, to leave us on somewhat more of a lighthearted note. This is absolutely hysterical. I don't know if it's hit everybody's radar, but every now and then people like to keep track of, you know, what is the biggest award ever asked for in a lawsuit? And that the bar has been lifted in that to stratospheric heights. The Au Bon Pain bakery chain is being sued for $2 undecillion. That is two with 36 zeros after it. And over at XKCD, they have done a whole what if on this that explains to you what an undecillion is and what two undecillion are, and puts it in perspective to how much more that is than everything that's ever been, all sellable stuff in the world, the economic value of all goods and services provided by humanity since we first evolved. If you were somehow able to monetize the entire galaxy or solar system, I think it was solar system, not galaxy, how you would still not be two undecillion. And then if you hired every Ted Olson in the galaxy to defend every one of these lawsuits, you still wouldn't even be there. So it's really, really funny. And all of this resulted from, I believe it was a dog bite and having a photograph taken by a Chinese couple. So, you know, you could really get up into the stratosphere.
Sounds like big bucks. Like big bucks for that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Corey Weather photography by any other ethnicities would have triggered such a high award, but I guess we'll never know. But
it was Au Bon Pain, so it was French. So, you know.
That's right. That's right.
My favorite line from that was, the Earth's crust is comprised of a bunch of atoms, and then it had the bracket citation needed. So that was brilliant.
That's what law review editors would tell us. Yeah, they would make us cite that in a law review article for sure.
Totally.
That's right. What if is about to become a whole book, by the way. So if you like this kind of humor, that would be up your alley. I know I enjoy that humor quite a bit. Anyway, guys, it's been really, really fun chatting with you. We covered a lot of ground and some difficult and really, really fascinating issues. I was completely behind the times in how many episodes of Oral Argument you've done. You're now on episode 22 with Dahlia Lithwick. The Supreme Court writer, very well-known Supreme Court writer. So, you know, definitely check that one out. And the whole body of shows, you guys have had some wonderful guests, Tom Goldstein, Christina Mulligan, who we had on a while ago, lots and lots of great stuff. So keep it up. We're thrilled that you're out there doing your show. And love the vibe that you guys achieve with it. It's very laid back and funny and cool, just sort of like you're a fly on the wall overhearing a couple of really entertaining law professors talk about really interesting things. So enjoy Thanks Oral Argument. We have enjoyed having Oral Argument on the show today. Joe and Christian, just couldn't be happier. I know you guys are on break now, but if there's anything going on at the University of Georgia Law School that you want to let people know about or something to pay attention to in the fall, now would be the time.
Well, we're looking for a new dean.
There's a dean search underway. Yeah. So that's, you know, we, you know, if you think you can be the dean of the law school, send in an application. Yeah.
we should get some good responses from that.
Sure.
Yeah. Evan, what do you think? You ready to move to Athens, Georgia?
I would love to move to Athens, Georgia. Not sure I'm quite qualified to be the dean of the law school, but I'd go down there if there were some other, you know, gainful opportunity.
Well, just like the law itself, the qualities that make for a good dean, who knows, right? So, you know, I don't know, Evan. I want to see your resume and hear your thoughts.
All right. I'll ship it to you.
Thanks so much for having us. So this was super fun. Really appreciate
it. It was great.
Our pleasure. I wonder, does Speedo modeling count as any sort of points toward deanhood? Because then Evan's got it sewn up.
Yeah, that's my most recent experience. You know, that's at the top. You know, so.
There is quite a bit of fundraising involved in being a law school dean, I think. And I've never heard of a Speedo method for raising funds, but who knows?
It's got to be a first time eventually.
Exactly.
I would definitely wear it in the dunk tank. People pay, you know, bucks to.
We're all about innovation here. Mm-hmm. Got to bring that about. All right. So, folks, we record the show at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC every Friday. So join us then if you'd like to join us live. We love to have you do that and jump on into IRC with us if you're watching the show live. If that doesn't work for you, look for us on iTunes and Roku and on YouTube. We're going to be in any of the channels where you like to subscribe to Netcast Entertainment. You can also just find us on our show page at twit.tv/twill. The whole archive is there. What else should we let you know about? We love talking to you between the shows. Please email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. We love hearing your thoughts and suggestions and responses to things that we have discussed. Dean applications, though, those should go straight to the University of Georgia School of Law. check us out on Facebook and Google Plus, too, if you need more than 140 characters to interact with us. If all you need is 140, then find us on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. Evan is internet cases over there. And so we look forward to hearing from you and to seeing you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.